From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In this year of presidential politics, there will be much talk of America's future, its development or decline as a social enterprise. But this, of course, is not new. One historical precedent lies in what cultural historians and critics call the Gilded Age, that period in American history from the end of the Civil War till roughly the turn of the 20th century. What was the Gilded Age? How did it get its name? And what were some of its social, political, and cultural preoccupations? In the first of two discussions for Soundings, the panelists are David Shy, Giles Gunn, and Robert Terhorst. David Shy and Robert Terhorst recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Professor Shy worked on his forthcoming book entitled The Simple Life, Plain Living and High Thinking in American Culture. Professor Terhorst worked on a project entitled The Fortunes of the Novel, a study in the transposition of a genre. David Shy teaches at Davidson College, Robert Terhorst at the University of Arizona. Giles Gunn is a professor of religion and American studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here is David Shy.
The Gilded Age, as a phrase denoting a certain historical period, derived from a satirical novel with the same title, written by Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner in 1873. It was a novel that was quite popular, and it portrayed American society in the aftermath of the Civil War as being awash with political corruption, industrialization, speculation, economic opportunities, get-rich-quick schemes, and was quite effective in satirizing and yet also revealing quite explicitly much of the realities of post-Civil War American society. That is, it was a period of dramatic industrialization, dramatic growth, economic opportunities, and Americans were eager to take advantage of those opportunities, frequently through unethical and illegal means. And the way in which most historians end the period is by noting a transition to the progressive era, as it is sometimes referred to. That is, an era in which political reform and idealistic social reformers dominated the scene far more than the
corrupt politicos of the Gilded Age.
I think that the epithet
gilded rather than golden was the result of the activities of the parvenus in the late 19th century, that is, those newly rich Americans who perhaps had not experienced affluence beforehand and suddenly found themselves to be quite wealthy and tended to spend their money, at least many of them, in rather gauche ways. That is, there were many famous balls and parties thrown by the wealthy elites of the cities on the eastern seaboard, in Chicago and San Francisco as well. Many parties that were quite ostentatious in their expenditure and in their motif. A famous one in New York, for example, all the guests, after eating a quite lavish dinner, were handed cigarettes wrapped in $100 bills, which they gleefully smoked, apparently inhaling the wealth. Another famous ball was held on horseback. Another one, a monkey was placed between each guest. There was, in fact, one in which the theme was poverty, in which all the rich guests were dressed as hobos, and they sat on crates and ate off tin plates. So there was the ostentatious quality that irritated many of the older elites, that is, those somewhat aristocratic and patrician New England families especially, who were quite irritated by what they considered to be the excesses of the nouveau riche. And it's in this sense, that is, the perception that many of the new rich in America were lacked taste, they lacked refinement, they lacked a sense of decorum, and that they were finding this new wealth and spending it in ways that were socially unacceptable. And of course, for the poor, as they read about this, this was of course a source of great indignation and irritation, and they felt that the new wealthy classes in America were quite callous toward their problems. And many of the newspapers, particularly those catering to a working class audience, quite frequently would provide long narratives of these ostentatious parties and pictures of the mansions in Newport and on Fifth Avenue to show how extravagant some of these expenditures were.
I have a question for Giles Gund. How did the churches react to all of this? Surely there must have been statements made and pamphlets written and sermons given. Was there any, what was the response, and did it have any impact on this, all of these social changes?
Well, I think the church's responses were in some sense divided. On the one hand, there were within various of the denominations certain lingering prophetic elements that were able to see this as but continuing evidence of the way in which America was betraying its mission by becoming enslaved with the god of Mammon, but the more interesting reaction of many of the churches and of many of its leading spokesmen was rather a tendency to see various of the developments associated with the Gilded Age as confirming America's special chosenness within the community of religious nations and as well signaling its particular favor in God's eyes.
So they were endorsing this after a fashion.
Yes, people like Henry Ward Beecher, for example, were essentially completely behind the development of material progress and equating that with a certain measure of spiritual advance.
During the Gilded Age, certainly the churches experienced a dramatic change in their composition, the congregational composition, with urbanization and immigration, for example. What tended to happen in the cities was that churches began to cater self-consciously to certain classes, so that you would have a Henry Ward Beecher, whose Brooklyn Church, one of the largest and most influential in the country, quite explicitly catered to the middle and upper middle class, as did another prominent Brooklyn preacher, DeWitt Talmage. And yet, the working classes, still the most populous element, began to feel left out of this, especially when some of these ministers were quite explicit in letting them know that they were not welcome. DeWitt Talmage, for example, said at one point that he didn't want working class parishioners coming in and causing discomfort for his own more genteel parishioners by their odor. Now that rather callous division between rich and poor that the preachers were
the washed and the unwashed.
That's right. Perceiving eventually stimulated a response on the part of some social reform-minded churchmen. And that generated a movement toward the end of the 19th century that became known as the social gospel, in which somewhat younger and more idealistic, or idealistic in a reform-minded way, preachers and ministers self-consciously tried to revive working-class churches in urban areas by addressing explicitly many of the political, social, and economic issues that the working classes, the unions, were pursuing in their self-interest. So there develops this interesting split in the late 19th century, really, in the congregations between middle, upper middle class, affluent congregations in the cities, on the one hand, and working class area churches that were quite socially active.
What about some of the other literary figures and cultural figures who might be said to represent or contradict or criticize the Gilded Age as a cultural phenomenon in the United States?
I think my nominee for the most representative writer of the age would no doubt be Mark Twain. But representative precisely because he was divided by what I take to be one of the most profound divisions of the age itself. On the one side, Twain was sensitive as almost no one else to the venalities of the age, to the ways in which people in their quest for status used money to try to garner it. And in book after book, he pointed out the shabbiness of reality that underlay the professed ideals of the age. On the other hand, he was himself finally captivated by its material attractions and
ruined by them.
And destroyed financially. And finally then wholly embittered as a result. And I think that that does tell us something about the age and about the kind of inner conflict, contradiction, in fact, that characterizes it. I think we've actually broached a number of interesting distinctions, and it might be worthwhile to pause only for a moment to try to clarify them. We can say that there are characters within books, like Colonel Sellers in The Gilded Age, who epitomize a dominant tendency of an age. We can also say, I think, that there are individuals, in this case writers, who perhaps embody in their life and work some of an age's central conflicts. In that sense, I was trying to argue that I think Mark Twain probably is the most representative writer of the age. But yet again, there are artists who don't necessarily embody the conflicts of an age, but understand those conflicts and are able to find ways of thinking about them and drawing out their implications, as I would argue that both Henry Adams does in The Education and Henry James does in a variety of fictions as well as in the American scene. I think these kinds of distinctions are important to keep in mind because the word representative is a slippery one, and we can mean it in several different senses.
I think perhaps one distinction would be the genteel or the patricians, the old families of New England, for example, that we referred to. They always insisted that money must be an instrument to higher culture rather than an end in itself. And I think many of them perceived among the newly rich an attitude or an ethic that saw money or the pursuit of money as an end rather than an instrument to something better or something higher. So that someone like Henry Adams or James Russell Lowell or Charles Eliot Norton looked with considerable disfavor on the business classes, or at least those members of the business classes, who seemed to be very vulgar in their approach to money and their spending of money and their attitude toward money, rather than using it for enlightened purposes. Now, indeed, many of these newly wealthy did become patrons of art, patrons of education, patrons of museum and other institutional forms of culture, but in some cases, as the genteel might argue, this was in itself a demeaning because they were attempting to buy culture for themselves rather than developing any true aesthetic sensitivity or sensibility in and of themselves. So that you have someone like J.P. Morgan, for example, buying up the paintings of Europe and then at some point having to ask one of his advisors, who is Vermeer? Do we need to buy some of him? So there was a sense of conspicuous consumption inherent in the philanthropy of many of these newly rich. So that tension was certainly evident between the old established families who considered themselves custodians of culture or the guardians of American high thinking, and feeling a sense of displacement by these new aggressive business elites who were indeed gaining great social influence, political influence, and economic power. And in the process, Americans were looking to them for inspiration and guidance, as opposed to the old elite, which felt that they should continue to be deferred to, and they were not being deferred to. So it is a complex issue, and certainly what we begin to see in the Gilded Age period is the stirrings of a rather aggressive American nationalism about its cultural quality. And we begin to take great pride in some of the American artists trained in American schools, such as Thomas Eakins, for example, in painting.
Well, there's another. I think what we're moving toward is another element which relates to progress and material expansion and so on. And this is really a Rousseauistic vein. After all, in the great century of the Enlightenment, the century which most cultivated and fostered, from an intellectual point of view, the idea of progress, the 18th century, also have that that negative voice, that of Rousseau, who wrote a famous essay which is anti-progressive. The essay which was proposed to him was whether the improvements in science have contributed to moral well-being. Rousseau kind of launched his career by taking the contrary point of view, saying that progress in science has not contributed to moral improvement. And so here we're looking at a counter tendency, which is cognate with the whole idea of progress. There's also a profoundly suspicious negative approach to the very idea of progress, which is almost there, present at the birth of it. And so when we're talking about American, there's a profoundly pessimistic, negative attitude of material culture in the American scene. And it's not necessarily a quality of the carping temperament of Americans who are unwilling to unreservedly accept the blessings of fast food restaurants, but rather is a suspicion of progress, which is philosophically present at the beginning, it seems to me.
I think perhaps the distinctive aspect of American literary criticism, social criticism in the late 19th century, is that we don't develop an American Tolstoy. That is, most of our novelists and literary critics of the period, despite their intense criticism of material vulgarity and acquisitiveness, nevertheless found themselves unable to advocate something either as an alternative in the form of Rousseau's primitivism or a true socialism. Even though someone like Howells was very much affected by his reading of Tolstoy and Tolstoy's personal example, Howells himself was never able to go beyond being what as someone called him, a fur-lined socialist. So that despite the cataclysmic tone of many of the novels of the late 19th century, and I'm thinking here of something like Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward. These novels, even though they provided utopian alternatives, nevertheless wanted to bring with them the trappings of technology, the benefits of progress, at the same time that they might possibly avoid some of the negative aspects of commercial advance. It's a continuing thread in the American experience, that is, the hope that somehow America can learn from the examples of other nations and cultures and reach this ideal situation, this synchronized development, whereby science and industry and commerce can advance, and at the same time, America's moral fiber, its republican virtue, can advance along with it. Unfortunately, many of the spokesmen for that ideal eventually admitted that it simply wasn't working out. Jefferson, for example, in one of his few despairing moments, said in 1807 that I regret to admit that our morals simply are not advancing with science. Now, he later came around to a more optimistic and hopeful outlook, and yet it is this frustrating realization that reoccurs throughout the American experience, that is the frustration that somehow our science and our technology and our industrial development do proceed much more vigorously and systematically and persistently, and somehow our moral and our cultural standards lag behind.
Is it too much of a jolt to try to figure Henry Adams into this equation? How he talks about himself as an 18th century man and being uncomfortable in the 19th century. What about that? Giles?
Well, he talks about himself as born in the 18th century, but having awakened in the 20th, as it were. And I think that in part simply dramatizes his sense of the rapidity of changes that had occurred to America within his own lifetime. It also means a good deal more. But Henry Adams, I think, did find the right word for precisely the sorts of, his word was multiplicity. Mm-hmm. And he felt that the American world, the world of the American experience in the Gilded Age, had become multiple in ways that it had not before. And he also realized that somehow or other this multiplicity, this pluralism, had to be seen in, there had to be some way of unifying it, or of creating an image or an idea of order that unified it, that held it together. And I would go on to say that strange as it may seem, just as the world was becoming more pluralistic during the Gilded Age, so I think there was, at least at one level of cultural life, a growing tendency to try to hold on to such elements of unity as America had access to. And the elements of unity that America had access to, I think, were part of what is still called the American myth, which was changing its definition or self-definition as the century progressed, but it nonetheless tended to hold sway.
Was the primary component in this myth or in this search for unity, this desire for unity on Adams' part, was it political, or is that too restricted? How would he have characterized it? A cultural kind of thing? Spiritual? What?
Well, more cultural and spiritual than political. I mean, it was a conceptual problem for him of how to imagine any kind of unified sense or idea of order in the midst of the immense, and he often felt dangerous, diversity of the approaching century.
Henry Adams had a very interesting theory about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Usually we think of a great empire's collapsing through lack of energy. But the theory of the fall of the Roman Empire, which Adams propounds, is that Rome had an excess of energy, that it exploded, that it blew up, couldn't contain and control its multiples of energy. And that would, I think, fit in very nicely with what Giles Gunn has been saying here, that the problem of multiplicity was how to harness all these particularities of energy and make them into a meaningful whole. It's really very much of a philosophical or scientific problem in Adams' mind.
I think it's also important to note that to the degree that Adams did not fulfill the expectations that he might have had for himself, if not others would have had for him, simply because of his place within the Adams line, he was extraordinarily sensitive to the failure of having done so, and indeed was then able to use, so to speak, the public failure of his own life to understand better the inability of so many men of talent and of strong good traditions to affect the course of things to come. And that was one of the things that was clearest to him, that he was in a profound sense a failure, and that his own personal failure was in some broader cultural sense representative. But then finally, it seems to me, what he did understand about the legacy of the Gilded Age and of the century to come was that perhaps the predominant problem of the time to come could be summed up in terms of the word force. This is what Adams was referring to with his image of the dynamo, where he was applying it more than anything else to the new fact of physical force. But he meant something beyond that, clearly. He meant, I think as well, that sensing oneself in the clutch of forces would become a predominant experience of people in the 20th century, and that, I think, has proved the case. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Adam's reflections on how to conceive of force, how to situate yourself in relation to force, foreshadowed, I think, many of the intellectual explorations that have been undertaken by various 20th century social thinkers as well as writers.
And by force you mean economics and politics, the big questions, the issues that swirl around one.
Yes, I think that's right. And force as an expression of power which seems not to have any obvious or easily comprehensible structures in which it expresses itself.
Making sense of things, in other words.
That's certainly part of it.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first of two discussions about the period in American society called the Gilded Age, the time between the end of the Civil War and the turn of the 20th century. The panelists were Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona, Giles Gunn of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and David Shy of Davidson College. The discussion continues next week on Soundings with further comments about Henry Adams, viewed by many cultural historians as a central figure in the Gilded Age. Soundings concludes now with a commentary about a question of widespread debate today, as in the Gilded Age, the issue of social progress. Here is Robert Ginger, an editorial writer and book critic for the Greensboro, North Carolina Daily News.
I wonder whether we always know what we mean by progress. Historian Robert Nisbet distinguishes between technological and spiritual progress. For any whole progress to occur, the two have to work together harmoniously. In his book, Nisbet shows progress to be an ancient and not a peculiarly modern tradition. He reminds us that historian Arnold Toynbee claimed a precise relation between technological advance and moral decline, that the former ensured the latter. Nisbet argues against this thesis, demonstrating that for the best minds, salvation lay in the increase of knowledge. It does my heart good to see Nisbet's book. In an age skeptical of progress, Nisbet attempts to show it as beneficent and antique. Genuine progress helps human beings to live better among one another in communities, the nation, and the world. In this sense, progress or genuine civilization includes everything from a decent provision for the poor to effective international diplomacy. Nisbet's fear is that the forces of pessimism may eventually drive progress from the Western world while it becomes more firmly entrenched in Eastern Europe and Asia. In the end, reasonable progress is the only thing that can dispel mass pessimism. But as Samuel Butler once noted, reasonable progress is more easily imagined than achieved. The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. Clearly, such progress would remove the egocentric and hedonistic elements, which Nisbet cites as threatening our civilization. Certainly, too, it would remove the nuclear escalation which takes the foreseeable out of foreseeable future. Only when the Western world's peoples and governments learn to value authentic progress will it become, as in the old General Electric motto, our most important product.
Robert Ginger is an editorial writer and book critic for the Greensboro, North Carolina Daily News. The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Next week on Soundings, part two of the discussion about American society during the Gilded Age. The topic will be Henry Adams. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.